This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, everyone. This is Steve Phelan with the Archives of American Heritage Magazine. This week, we're starting a new story called The Ultimate Storm. The Great Lakes Hurricane of 1913 was a destructive freak. This is by Bruce Catton. It was written in October-November of 1984. Somewhere in the emptiness between Hudson Bay and the Rockies, a vagrant puff of wind raised a dusty snow and went skittering over the plains, picking up a spiral here and another one there to create a North Country November blizzard of the kind that rages lustily for a few days and then blows itself out with no great harm done. But in this first week of November 1913, things were a bit different. Far off to the southeast, a low-pressure area had formed over the Great Lakes. The growing disturbance in Canada was drawn by that low-pressure area, and the blizzard went sliding over the curve of the earth, growing wide and deep and strong, carrying great banks of evil clouds as if it were backpacking the material for further growth and development. It grew out of the region where there was little for it to harm and swept down on the world's busiest waterway where immeasurable damage could be done. On Friday, November 7th, taking note of all this, the Weather Bureau ordered storm warnings hoisted at all its stations on the lakes, a square red flag with a square black center, flown with a pennant that shows the storm's direction. It is an ominous signal to look at when a rising wind whips the flag away from the staff and the clouds are piling higher and higher, but Great Lakes shipmasters are hard to scare. The end of autumn always brings storms, but the steel ships are sturdy and they are ably handled. And besides, in those days, the navigation season on the lakes closed around December 1st, and it was important to finish as many trips as possible before the winter layup. A cargo carrier lying in harbor waiting for good weather earns no dividends, and no good marks for the skipper either. But this time, the Weather Bureau and the shipmasters were up against something new. This was not just another western snowstorm, it was an outright hurricane. Born freakishly in the North Country instead of the tropics, and it spun into that densely traveled stretch of water like nothing the lake people ever saw before or since. To this day, it is remembered as the Great Storm of 1913, the worst the lakes ever had. It destroyed 19 ships. A dozen of them were lost with all hands, and no one will ever know just how and when they sank. And it drove 20 more onto the rocks. It drowned 250 sailors, and it caused millions of dollars in property damage to various shoreside cities and towns. As far as the lakes are concerned, this was the ultimate storm. To anyone used to the wide oceans, the lakes look like reasonably sheltered bodies of water. The appearance is deceptive. The winds have plenty of room to rampage, and there are a few special problems the Lakers have to encounter that are unknown on the high seas. To begin with, the lake's shipmaster is never far from a lee shore. If a storm blows up, he cannot run before it for very long, nor does he dare to heave to and drift along while the storm blows itself out. That's all right on the ocean, where there is plenty of sea room, but the shipmaster who tries this on the lakes would eventually go on to the rocks. If the storm comes off the land, he may escape the worst of it by hugging the coastline, but then, if the wind suddenly shifts and blows in the opposite direction, he is almost certain to be blown ashore. Another problem comes from the peculiar shape of the lake freighters. They carry bulk cargoes, ore, limestone, coal, grain, which are loaded and unloaded by machinery. So they are long and slim, with a great row of cargo hatches running almost from one end to the other of the boat. Parentheses, be it noted, on saltwater, A boat is a small, undecked craft, and a cargo carrier that is decked and has quarters for crew and possibly for passengers in a ship. Not so on the lakes. The word ship has never taken hold on fresh water, and huge carriers 500 or 600 feet long or more are still boats. In any case, a typical lake boat in 1913 had bridge, pilot house, and quarters for the captain and other deck officers in the bow, as far forward as possible, with coal bunkers, engine room, galley, engineers' cabins, and quarters for the coal passers, firemen, oilers, and usually deckhands as well, in the extreme stern. When the captain and the chief engineer had a jurisdictional dispute, which did happen now and then, the engineer would say, quote, "You take care of your end of the boat, and I'll take care of mine." The boat has to be narrow so it can go through the locks at Sault Ste. Marie, and in 1913 it had to be of shallow draft to negotiate the various rivers and straits that lie between Lake Superior and Lake Erie. As a result, it was built like a flat-bottomed canal boat, and everything between the captain's end and the engineer's end was cargo space, an expanse of open deck, longer than a football field, studded with a great succession of cargo hatches, giving easy access at the dock to the loading chutes and the prodigious cranes and scoops for unloading. In a bad storm, especially one that coats everything with ice, it could be quite impossible to go from one end of the boat to the other, which meant that the people in the bridge were likely to go hungry. All of these peculiarities of construction mean that the lake's sailors has a few problems the saltwater man does not. With some modifications, the old design is still followed. The boat is very long and narrow, and when loaded heavily with ore or coal, it has a low freeboard. That's the portion that's above the water level. If it falls into the trough of a heavy seaway, it rolls infernally. It may roll all the way over, in which case it eventually is posted as, quote, "lost with all hands." So you stay out of the trough, or if you get into it, you get out as quickly as possible. But in the ultimate storm, things can happen. Another item, when the bridge and pilot house are very close to the stern, a really tremendous head sea can drive waves, not spray, but tons of water, right up against or clear over them. In that case, something is likely to give, and the whole command position, along with the people commanding, can get thrown off onto the windy deck. Bits of wreckage usually come ashore after a week or two. A similar wave may drive along the entire length of the open deck, putting an abnormal strain on hatch combings and covers. In 1913, the various improvements that make today's hatches almost stormproof had not yet been devised. A boat running before the wind faced a similar danger at the engineer's end. If the craft got pooped, P-O-O-P-E-D, the wave might not only wash out the galley and living quarters, but could also smash in the engine room skylights and send solid water down into the engine room, which meant interesting times for the black gang, the coal loaders, and in an extreme case could mean total disaster for everyone. It ought to be added that in 1913 hardly any freighters had radios, and none had direction finders or radar. The great storm of 1913 was enough to try the staunchest vessel to the limit. The Lake Carriers Association, which speaks for shipowners as a group, issued a statement afterward that discusses the big blow almost with awe, as if the men who wrote it found the English language not quite adequate to say what they wanted said. Quote, "No lake master can recall, in all his experience, a storm of such unprecedented violence, with such rapid changes in the direction of wind and its gusts of such fearful speed," they said. "Storms ordinarily of that velocity do not last over 4 or 5 hours, but this storm raged for 16 hours continuously at an average velocity of 60 miles an hour, with frequent spurts of 70 and over. The testimony of Masters is that the waves were at least 35 feet high and followed each other in quick succession. The wind and sea were frequently in conflict, the wind blowing one way and the sea running in the opposite direction. It may be centuries before such a combination of forces may be experienced again. The freakish nature of the storm seemed to hint that all rules were off. On the night of November 6th, before the storm warnings went up, the steamer Cornell was heading west on Lake Superior, 40 miles out of the Sioux Locks, a mild southeast breeze following. Suddenly, toward midnight, the Cornell encountered tremendous waves from the northwest. The following breeze died. There were confused puffs and blasts from nowhere for a few minutes. Then a whole gale came driving in from the northwest, bearing blinding snow and freezing temperatures. On the same evening, the J.H. Sheidel battened down her hatches on a cargo of grain at Fort William, some 200 miles northwest of the Cornell's position, and set out for the lower lakes. Upon clearing Thunder Cape, she met such a sea and wind from the southwest that her captain pulled back to shelter and waited until the morning of November 7th, when the winds swung around to the north and he could go on with his voyage. While the Sheidel was waiting for better weather, the L.C. Waldo sailed from two harbors with iron ore and got the worst of it, towering following seas that smashed pilot house, steering wheel, and compass, and drove the blinded vessel onto a reef off the tip of Kennesaw Point. The Waldo was broken in half. By some prodigy of good luck and rugged self-help, her crew survived for 90 hours in the forward end until shore people were able to come out and take them off. On Lake Michigan, the barge Plymouth anchored near St. Martin's Island to ride out the storm, icy waves breaking over her, but not quite able to take her down. When rescuers finally reached the barge, they found an eerie scene. The crew of seven had lashed themselves to the rail and rigging to keep from going overboard, and all of them had frozen to death. From Lake Michigan comes just about the only lighter note in the whole story of this storm. The steamer Illinois was carrying package freight from Mackinac Island to Chicago when the gale struck, and her captain took shelter in the lee of South Manitou Island. The wind was too strong. The sharp slope of the bottom offered no holding ground for the anchors, and the captain finally drove the Illinois' bow up onto the beach and sent men ashore with a hawser, a long rope, to tether the big steamer to a stout tree, for all the world as if she were a rowboat tied up for the night on an inland pond. This unconventional mooring held, and eventually the skipper was able to resume his voyage and go on to Chicago. All the rest of the story is grim. The Louisiana, bound for Alpena to get ore, steamed head-on into the storm and found herself borne straight backward and broken on the beach of Washington Island. Not far away, the Halsted went hard aground on an offshore reef to be picked up when she was on the verge of coming to pieces by an extra big wave, lifted clear over the reef and put high on the beach so that her crew could clamber down from her bow to dry land and perfect safety. On Lake Superior, the Lee Field, carrying steel rails to Port Arthur, went missing with all hands. The Turret Chief got to the middle of Lake Superior before the storm took its final charge. It drove her far off course and finally put her on the rocks off Keweenaw Peninsula. She was close ashore, and the crew managed to scramble to solid ground, but they had no idea where they were, and there was a howling snowstorm. They spent Saturday night and Sunday in a driftwood hut they built. On Monday, they plodded grimly off through the wilderness. They finally reached a small town with shelter and warmth and food, 50 chilly, hungry hours after their boat was wrecked. Usually, when a westerly gale sweeps Lake Superior, it blows itself off into the northern Ontario wilderness, and the shipmasters assumed this one would do the same. When the J.H. Sheidel, which had been stormbound coming from Fort William, locked down at the Sioux, that is, passed through the locks, bound for the lower lakes. It was 8:30 on the evening of Saturday, November 8th, and her skipper had planned to lie low until the storm abated. In a few hours, the wind died and the snow stopped falling, so he continued on down the St. Mary River and went out into Lake Huron early on Sunday morning, November 9th. There was a light breeze from the north-northeast, and everything seemed peaceful. Ahead of him was the James Carruthers, followed by the Hydrus, and the three boats steamed out on what looked like a routine cruise down to Lake Erie. The Sheetal eventually made it. Nobody ever saw the other two boats again. Apparently, Lake Huron was on good behavior until somewhere around 8:30 Sunday morning, when the Sheetal was off Thunder Bay. Then came the switch. The mild breeze became a living northeast gale, bringing a heavy snowstorm with it, and any skipper who had been steering close to the Michigan shore in order to get protection if the northwest gale reappeared found himself dangerously close to shipwreck. Nobody could see anything at all at the foot of the lake, where the St. Clair River leads past Port Huron to Detroit and on to Lake Erie, the Fort Gratiot, G-R-A-T-I-O-T, lightship had been blown 2 miles from its proper position. It would have been a beacon leading to disaster, except that in the whirling snow, nobody could see it. A boat that had a deep-sea sounding machine and a skipper who was thoroughly familiar with the channel depths all along the thumb to Port Huron could feel its way to safety, parentheses, providing her engines had enough power to keep the storm from taking complete charge. The Sheetal survived that way. The waves washed out the galley, put 4 feet of water in the after cabin, and deluged the men in the engine room. Many ships did not make it. In addition to the Hydrus and James Carruthers, the John A. McGean, Isaac M. Scott, Argus, Andrus, Wexford, Regina, and Charles S. Price were all lost. Nobody ever knew just where, when, or how they sank. They simply disappeared, and there were no survivors. For a fortnight or more, bodies drifted onto the Ontario coast at the lower end of the lake. There was a mystery here. One of the bodies was definitely identified as a member of the engine room force of the Charles S. Price, but when it came ashore, it was wearing one of the Regina's life jackets. A day or so later, other bodies, similarly identified as belonging to the Price's crew, came ashore, each one wearing a Regina jacket. As far as anybody knew, the two ships had not been in company. How did the men get into the jackets? The only possible explanation seemed to be that the two ships had collided, mortally injuring each other, and that some of the Price's people scrambled aboard the Regina in those last desperate moments. But a few days after the storm died down, the all but submerged hull of a big cargo boat, bottom side up, temporarily kept at the surface by air trapped in the hull, was found in the open about a dozen miles north of the Port Huron exit. Very little of this dead craft could be seen, and it seemed important to make an identification. So a diver was taken out to the boat until he found, and he went 20 or 30 feet underwater and groped along the submerged plates of the bow until he found the raised letters giving the boat's name. In the green darkness, he traced them with his hands, spelling the words out letter by letter, then surfaced to report. It was the Charles S. Price. Before anything could be done in the way of salvage, the trapped air escaped, and the hull went to the bottom, and it has been there ever since. The diver reported that he found no signs of collision damage, but it has never been clear whether he examined enough of the hull to be certain that no collision had taken place. Strange business. And there was more. Just before the Price sailed from Cleveland on her final voyage, an engineering officer named Milton Smith had a powerful hunch. He simply did not want to sail on this trip, so he took himself off the payroll, parentheses, despite the pleading of the chief engineer, and stayed ashore. It was he who later went to Ontario and identified certain bodies as those of crewmen from the Charles S. Price. The sort of thing that must have happened to some of the lost ships was described later by the captain of the steamer Matoa, which started up Lake Huron early Sunday morning, November 9th, with a load of coal for the Upper Peninsula. The Matoa was about 6 hours out of Port Huron, steaming north through a sea that was giving no trouble at all, when she suddenly met tremendous waves sweeping down the lake, followed by a blinding snowstorm. The after cabin was wrecked, and the galley and mess room were washed out, with tons of water down in the engine room. On the open deck, the strong backs holding down three hatch covers were carried away. The temperature dropped to 15 degrees, and the after part of the boat was quickly encased in ice. In desperation, the captain of the Matoa, needing a harbor of refuge above all things, took the considerable chance of turning his boat around, got the wind astern at last, and ran before the storm. The Matoa fought the storm in mid-lake all day long. The captain was just beginning to hope that the worst was over when the deck plates began to split open, and it was obvious that the Matoa was going to break up, at which point she ran hard aground on a reef not far from Point O'Barks. Quote, "It's lucky that we stranded," the captain said later, adding that in open lake they could not have stayed afloat another half hour. After roosting on the rocks for 2 long days, the crew was rescued by a tugboat. The Matoa was a complete loss. Similar was the experience of the Howard M. Hanna, Jr., which set out from Lorain, Ohio, for Fort William, Ontario, on Saturday morning, coming up into Lake Huron about the same time as the Matoa. The weather was good, and the northwest breeze was light. Then, after a few hours, the wind boxed the compass, swinging around to southeast, then on to northeast, and finally to north-northeast. Snow flurries developed into a blinding snowstorm, and then the worst of it came all at once, full orchestra, wrecking the after cabin and sending torrents down into the engine room. The Hanna could make no headway. With engines working at full speed, she could not even hold her head to the wind, and presently she dropped off and fell into the trough, rolling heavily but never quite going all the way over. Sometime after 10 on Sunday night, the storm slammed the helpless vessel onto an offshore reef near Port Austin Light. The crash broke the hull in half. The smokestack was already gone. Fore and aft, the deck houses were wrecked, and while the deck force took what shelter they could at the captain's end of the boat, the rest of the crew huddled in the wreckage at the engineer's end. The Hanna was, of course, unsalvageable. Somehow, lifesavers got out and rescued the crew. One more. The steamer H.B. Hawgood, running light, that is, without cargo, came out into Lake Huron and got the full force of the storm without delay. She was completely helpless, unable to steam ahead or to maneuver. Her captain anchored, but he might as well have saved himself the trouble. After dragging her anchors for 8 miles, the Hawgood hit the beach, and all hands eventually were rescued. The captain remarked afterward, "But for the crash on the beach just in time, there would have been another missing ship." He added, quote, "By God, that wind blew full 75 miles an hour." The great center for steamboat ownership and control in those days, and to a large extent today, was Cleveland. Due to an oddity of the storm, Cleveland was probably the last place on the lakes to get a clear picture of the disaster that had befallen her cargo carriers. The storm hit Cleveland on Sunday and Monday, and for the time being, the city was completely isolated. Railroad trains could not get in or out. Streetcar and suburban systems were paralyzed. City traffic was hopelessly blocked. Snowdrifts 8 feet deep were reported on some streets, and telegraph lines were down. It was days before Cleveland knew what had happened out on the open lake. As a matter of fact, it was days before anyone knew the extent of the damage, for many of the boats that had survived the storm were long overdue when they made port. On Lake Superior and the upper end of Lake Huron, many craft edging their way into port were all but unrecognizable because of the masses of ice that had formed around their deckhouses and pilot houses. In most cases, crewmen took axes to chop away enough ice so the man at the wheel could see where he was going. In other cases, it was necessary to hook up steam hoses and melt the ice. The lakes are still hit by prodigious storms now and then, and stout cargo carriers are still lost. But there's never been anything like the big storm of 1913, and there probably never will be because equipment has improved. Hatch covers today are much stronger, more solidly fastened, almost impossible to dislodge. Radio beacons give shipmasters a clear guide, even when snow and ice and wrecked lightships make it impossible for a skipper to see where he is going. Ship-to-shore communications now make it possible for a captain to get up-to-the-minute weather forecasts. It is unlikely the disaster of 1913 could ever be repeated. Nobody on the lakes will miss it. And for the Archives of American Heritage magazine, that's it. This was Steve Phelan. Folks, I'll see you next week.